Tech conferences offer a lot of nice perks, not the least of which is the chance to visit exotic locales like Boston and Silicon Valley and write it off as a business expense. But even greater than that, tech conferences offer the chance to get new perspectives on your work and discover some overall trends you may not have been aware of. Earlier this December, our very own David Weinberger had a chance to attend Supernova 2009, a conference that invites members of the business, government, and academic communities to explore the transformation of computing, communications, business, and society in the network age. As we say goodbye to this year and say hello to 2010, David Weinberger joins us to report back on three of the major themes for the web of 2009 and where these trends might be going next year.
I'm very lucky to actually be able to turn the microphone on you this time and ask you questions about a conference that you recently attended. Tell me, what is Supernova? What was it all about?
Supernova was founded only a few years ago. The idea was to bring together people who are involved in the telecommunications industry on all sides. So people representing the incumbents, the big telcos, and also people who are trying to be insurgents into this industry. Kevin Werbach, the founder of Supernova, was in a very good position to do that. He's an ex-FCC guy. He's currently a professor at Wharton. He's respected by, let's say, all sides in this, and so he has pulled together a conference that's actually really, really good.
And this year, has it been different this year than it has been in previous years?
It was a little bit smaller, a little bit homier this year, and it's sort of a natural consequence of the economic downturn for a lot of conferences, but it was still substantial. There were also a number of Obama administration officials who were there.
And that's something we'll get into in a little bit. But you identified a few major threads coming out of this.
Yes, I don't think that these were consciously decided upon. But if you had to, you could say that sort of clustered around three different topics. And the first is policy, FCC, broadband initiative policy.
Well, let's talk about that first one, that broadband initiative, because that is something that is very hot button right now, with the FCC putting together a plan of action. What was the kind of tone at the conference around broadband?
It depends who you speak to. So there were lots of really interesting conversations. If I had to guess, I would say that the majority of the attendees tend towards the insurgent side. But there was still pretty good representation and lots of opportunities to talk with regulators, for example, and people who have been in positions, regulatory position, or occasionally actually are now. One of the gets, so to speak, at the conference was Larry Strickling, who's head of the National Telecommunications and Information Administration, the NTIA, who the agency that represents the Obama administration's position on these issues. It's a little hard to carry because he's the head of an agency and thus he's that's in process for evaluating grants, stimulus grants, that will come out to a total of $5.6 billion. And so properly, he's a little cagey, let's say, about where he's going. But one of the telling questions I thought was somebody asked him about the stomach the agency has for proposals that are edgy and experimental. And he was quite straightforward. I have to say he was quite straightforward about everything. That given a choice between funding a program that has a small chance of success versus one that pretty sure is going to work and maybe put people to work, they're going to go for the ones that they're sure are going to work, which may make sense, but it does mean that the we'll have fewer experimental projects than we might think. It's also seemed clear from what he was saying that he has a strong preference for proposals that wire up the town anchors, as they say, the government offices, the library, the schools, so that at least there's good internet there, and then you can build out from there, open them up to the community.
So the web would be like the town well, as it were, before everyone gets running water, you've got it at least in a few locations around the town.
Yes, with the hope that if you have the town well, you can also build the pipes out to people's houses. Because I don't think anybody will be happy if it stays. You have to go into the library to use the internet. I mean, that's not what I think any of us want. Nevertheless, as the starting point, I mean, there are lots of different ways of doing this, and that's one type of starting point. And that seems to be, from what he said, or at least what I took from what he said, to be the direction they're going in.
And you got a couple chances to talk to some of the thinkers on broadband and the people who are both thinking and moving on broadband from either side of the spectrum in your capacity as a reporter, producer, interviewer.
Yes, what you mean is I had a little camera and a microphone, so as I am now a journalist. That's amazing. Yes, for example, I talked with Paul Brigner of Verizon, who I think did a very good job in the little interview of extemporaneously presenting the case that Verizon makes, their view of the world.
When you're dealing with a very changing and dynamic environment like this, trying to put a plan around it is challenging, to say the least. But if I were in that position, I would have to say first, my reaction would be to do no harm, to say that we've made good progress, and to look at where we've come from, and to also acknowledge the investment that private companies have made, like Verizon. Some of the numbers are quite impressive. Verizon, over the last 5 years, has invested over $80 billion in capital to build its networks. And that is, in fact, greater than any other company has invested, as far as private capital goes, over that period of time. So I think you must continue to foster that and create an ecosystem that is going to ensure that that continues. Because the reality is that in order to bridge the gap between where we are now and to get to ubiquitous broadband, the FCC has estimated that that's up to a $350 billion problem. And certainly the government's not going to be funding that level of investment given our current economic situation. So I would say look at the policies that have got us here to date and ensure that we continue to foster those. And that has mostly been a deregulatory policy. It has allowed the private market to work, and you have been when there's been everything that has happened has been to incentivize investment, and that has worked.
Okay, so unpack a little bit of that for me.
Verizon has been the major deliverer of fiber to the home. That's their strategy. So they're rolling out optical fiber, and it's very high speed, and it's been quite a successful strategy for Verizon. It's also very expensive for them to do that. And so, as I understand it, Paul's position is that, look, we're succeeding here, and we've made good progress. It would be insanely expensive for the government to do this, so let us just keep on doing what we're doing. Do no harm. Don't take away the incentives for investment that currently enable Verizon to make a business doing this, to find it a profitable business.
And for them, that's true. I mean, Verizon is leading the pack in terms of the speed that they offer.
Yes, because they're rolling out fiber, and fiber is the ultimate high-speed delivery system. So in this this little piece we heard, Paul is defending against proposals that would regulate the environment and introduce either more competition or in some other way devalue what they're offering. But of course, this argument rests in part on the assumption that we are in fact doing well right now and thus ought to continue in what we're doing. And I raise that question with Paul because there have been studies that say that in fact the U.S. is comparatively doing at best sort of okay. We're in the middle of the pack, not leading. So I asked him about that.
You can't make direct comparisons between different countries. I think the FCC has looked at this, and there's kind of a consensus that was developed on the panel that focused on this issue that those direct comparisons really don't acknowledge the progress that we made, and they don't account for the differences in the countries. You know, of course, in many countries where they have great broadband access, a lot of that is due to a very dense population or very specific demographics or a geography. So I think you have to be very careful when trying to do international comparisons because they really might not make sense.
So he's got a problem with the idea that we're not doing well as a country.
It's a very, very controversial view. So much depends upon this question. If we're doing really badly, then it's much more likely that we should change our approach. If we're doing really well, then we just sort of need to extend our approach. There is so much at stake here that this question has been carefully looked at and argued at every turn.
And that might be more than we can probably unpack here, but hopefully we'll be able to talk to Yochai sometime in the new year as we get closer to the February report deadline. Paul used this term, do no harm. What does that kind of mean?
Well, it's springing up more and more. It comes obviously out of the Hippocratic Oath that doctors, first of all, should do no harm. And frequently it has a particular sort of coded meaning. I mean, people within the industry know what it means. And Paul, in fact, explains that.
I think that you have the potential for unintended consequences coming from regulations that might impose net neutrality, to be more specific. And, you know, I think that whenever you try to mandate non-discrimination on the internet, while it sounds very good and you know, it is encouraging an open internet, something that we promote is an open internet, but when you get down to the technical, the technicalities of that, you're going to create a problem with being able to manage networks and being able to deploy new services.
From the point of view of Verizon and other carriers, net neutrality looks like regulation by the FCC that's telling them how to best manage their network. And they're very concerned with their ability to provide good service, defined in some sense, to their users. And so they don't like the heavy hand of government telling them how to manage the bits that are going through their pipes.
To me, it seems like Verizon is taking a very status quo kind of approach to this.
Well, they are the status quo, so it's to their advantage. They want to be able to continue doing what they're doing and maybe even more. They don't want to be displaced by some new strategy, broadband initiative strategy that says we'll reach all these unreached customers some other way. That's just not to their business advantage, and their argument is that it's not to the country's advantage either. If we are doing well in terms of delivering this stuff, if the system works, then disrupting the system will slow the delivery of broadband access. Whereas, you know, the broadband initiative that we have going is all about doing the opposite. So from their point of view, steady as we go, maybe turn up the gas a little bit, take away some of the remaining regulations so they can go ahead. But they are suggesting some changes, right? It's not simply, let's just keep going. They actually have an idea for a positive policy that they think would help.
The FCC should focus on those who have not adopted broadband, who have access to broadband. And there's really a large number of people. We're talking about 30 million people, or 30 million households, I'm sorry, that have not adopted broadband, who have access to it. And there's a lot that the government can do there to encourage and incentivize those households to adopt.
So for Verizon, this is low-hanging fruit. It's people who have access. There's an access provider who's running past their door, but they haven't taken up the opportunity. The FCC, the broadband initiative folks, the strategy folks, are very, very interested in this because this is, for them, low-hanging fruit, too. They want to get as many people on as possible, too, although possibly for a different reason than the commercial entities want. There's a shared interest there. And so the FCC is being quite open to and receptive to ideas that will increase the adoption rate, which means increasing the perceived relevancy, you know, why you would want to adopt, and providing the sorts of skills training that our Berkman colleague Esther Harkadai has been researching, skills that enable people to succeed, because simply throwing people into a room with a computer is not a good path to adoption. Paul also talks about increasing the value of the web to people's lives and doing it with government programs that, for example, would get more of the government services online. At the other end of the spectrum is, for example, Esme Voss, who is there, who runs a site and a informational advocacy service, muniwireless.com. And she advocates requiring the people who provide the infrastructure of access to open up their infrastructure to competitors. And so you'd have other ISPs using your infrastructure. You'd be charging them wholesaler prices. So you are making some money because you're charging them, but you'd be opening it up to your competitors.
In countries we see where there is a lot of broadband competition, it's because the regulators have forced that to happen. So the only alternative we're left with in the United States is to actually build a separate infrastructure, separate from that of the incumbent operators, cable and telecom operators, and that's the middle mile projects that the NTIA is trying to fund, the RUS is trying to fund, and that some cities, because they managed to actually, you know, deploy fibered rings, fiber optic networks, are open to other service providers. That's what they've done. So they built a completely separate infrastructure. And once that's in place, service providers have an alternative to the incumbent operator's own infrastructure, a cheaper one, and they can pass on the cost savings to their customers.
What I'm wondering is how that works. If I'm a service provider that owns my pipes, even if the government tells me to open up my infrastructure to allow other services to use it, what added value are those services that are using my pipes wholesale giving?
They might compete with you on price, or they might compete with you on services. They may, for example, offer a child-safe internet. That would require violating net neutrality, but that's another issue, right? Or they might offer you the ability to pay for very high-speed internet for particular uses. Maybe you're a gamer or you're a doctor who wants to transmit at night. You want to transmit large digitized X-rays or whatever. There are a variety of services that they could offer that would allow, or compete on price, that would allow you them to compete with the people providing the initial access.
So it's services on top of the infrastructure.
It could be, yes, and it could be simply better technical support. We have somebody 24/7 you can call and get immediate access to.
But when the wire breaks, I, as the person who owns the wire, has to go out and send the technician to fix it.
That's right, because first of all, you are also selling access, and you are charging those other ISPs to allow them to provide access to others. So you have a very clear business incentive to make sure your network is operating.
Okay, and there are other issues around access besides the pipes themselves.
Yeah, so I asked Elliot Noss this question. Elliot is the founder of Two Cows, T-U-C-O-W-S. He's based in Toronto. His company is a internet domain registrar. So when you have a new domain name, he'll register it for you. And I asked him what the U.S. can learn from Canada's experience with broadband. And he answered by saying what the U.S. and Canada could learn from other countries.
Where both of us can learn is from Australia. You know, Australia has done a couple things right, like the U.S., and unlike Canada to date, they've made a very clear commitment to broadband. But much more importantly, their commitment to broadband is to what I would call real broadband. So their commitment is to at least 100 megabits a second. They recognize the value of symmetrical bandwidth, and they're talking about, you know, even a gig being what's relevant, and I think that's right.
And just for scale, what would be a sort of normal U.S.-Canadian broadband rate?
I think, you know, most people are dealing with 2 to 10 megabits a second downstream, and if they're lucky, 1 megabit upstream.
What counts as broadband, and then what counts as fast broadband, is actually a very tricky question, and one that the broadband strategy folks are wrestling it with. Their charge is to come up with a plan for delivering, you know, near ubiquitous broadband access, but the charge itself does not say what constitutes broadband. And the FCC has a history in the previous administration of defining broadband as such a low rate that nobody in the country would consider it to be broadband. So they have to decide what's going to be an acceptable rate. Elliot points to 100 megabit. That is just so much faster. It's 2 times faster than what you can get from the as I understand it, from the fastest Verizon cable optical fiber network. And it is way faster, order of magnitude faster than what most of us have.
And there's the speed that we're advertised as, like, as the service is advertised as, you know, in the States, the high end might be 25, it sounds like, whereas it might be 100 in Korea. And then you got into something a little bit more interesting about symmetrical broadband, and that's a new term for me. Can you explain that a little bit?
That just means the rate going when you're downloading something, including looking at a web page, which of course involves a download of that page, and the rate of uploading, whether you're uploading a photo or a video to one of the sites, or you're playing a video game, which also involves a lot of downloading and a lot of uploading. And you want to have, for a video game, for example, you want to have pretty fast upload. Otherwise, you have the traditional lag that will get you, you know, eliminated pretty quickly.
So you asked him a little bit about that. Let's hear that clip.
You know, that symmetry point is a very important one, because a lot of the kind of the incumbent telcos and cable cos are starting to do some more interesting things with downstream speeds. You know, I know there are some offerings now, the Verizon Fios offering. There's some offerings in Canada on the cable co side where they're talking about up to 25 and 50 megabits downstream. But those offerings still have horrid upstream. And to really appreciate the difference there, you know, I think that the best way to think about it is to look at Korea. You know, I had the luxury of being in Korea last month, and I was blown away with not just, you know, the broadband and the infrastructure, but what it had left in its wake. So a commitment to high-speed broadband that was symmetrical, you know, I would argue, and in fact, you know, the Koreans will say, was directly contributory towards their, you know, where they are right now, which is dominant in gaming. So they are by far the leading, you know, gaming country in the world. And, you know, when you think about downstream, you think about consuming a movie. When you think about upstream, you think about interactivity. And that interactivity is what gaming requires. You know, right now, gaming is already a bigger market globally than movies, and it's obviously growing much faster. So it's a great lesson that I think we both can learn.
Even so, it's not clear that we need full symmetry. Some people have argued that, in fact, most of our usage of the web is browsing, and thus it's downloading. And so it might make sense to have faster download speeds, because we're doing more of that than upload, even if we are fully participatory in Web 2.0 and all of that. So I asked Elliot, do we really need symmetry?
You know, I think we're in a place today where we can't say whether, you know, 100 megs down and 50 megs up is fine, where full symmetry, 100 down, 100 up is, you know, so much better. We can't say that. But what I can say is that it's an architectural decision, and it's a business model decision. It's not a technical limitation. And, you know, boy, the great thing about the internet is that if you provide the opportunity, you know, things happen.
That really kind of blows my mind, because it's a kind of an imagination of a world that we don't have access to right now. Can anybody kind of predict what kind of services and opportunities we might have if we did have that kind of upstream capability here?
There are lots of ideas and examples of what people might do. Some of them are pretty provocative. But of course, the most interesting ones are going to be the ones that we can't envision, because people aren't going to think of them until they take for granted that upstream is going to be as easy as, even if not entirely symmetrical, but is going to be as easy as downstream.
Is upstream a question that that comes up as a kind of hot button in this reform issue?
You know, it comes up occasionally. It doesn't come up, in my experience, all that often as one of the hot issues. It doesn't, not in the way that, say, net neutrality does. The problem is that having a lot of upstream will generate the demand for a lot of upstream, and not having it, you just sort of take for granted that there are things that you wouldn't think of doing because it would take too long to upload them. So, you know, you may have a theoretical commitment to the possibilities that more upstream would give, but there isn't the sort of, I think, obviously, there isn't the sort of customer demand for it that will drive the commercial access providers to provide it.
Sort of a catch-22, chicken or egg.
Yes, and it's a coded message also. So what it often stands for is the demand for symmetry or something like it, is it's a declaration that you have a particular view of the internet. That one view of the internet is that it is a source of content and maybe TV, and that it's something that we consume. And then the other camp declares that no, the internet is a place in which we participate fully as equals, and everybody's voice has a right to be heard, and everybody's video has a right to be seen. And so people who are asking for symmetry often are expressing their adherence to that second camp.
So we also talked about two other threads. One of them was the kind of growth in real-time collaborative work. So there's a perfect segue of that from the question of symmetry. What did you kind of find out was the mood around the idea of what real-time means right now?
There was a huge amount of energy around it and excitement about it. It's the exciting leading edge. There were a lot of references to Twitter. There was a huge amount of tweets coming out of it. In fact, I think that the Supernova hashtag was congesting the tweet search engine for a while. There were so many. I mean, there'd be 100 in just a few seconds. Every time you went to refresh, there'd be another 100 to look at.
Well, why this year? I mean, they've had, I imagine at Supernova, they've had Twitter since before Twitter was even available to most people.
I asked Kevin Werbach that.
Well, it's just where it is in the cycle. So Twitter's been around for several years, but it's taken off in the last year and a half or so, to the point where in the technology community, which is the bulk of people who are involved in Supernova, it's totally ubiquitous. In some ways, in not a new way. There's nothing that's there in Twitter that fundamentally wasn't in email and IRC and so many other things that existed for a while. But it puts it together in a way that's just catalyzed this kind of takeoff in volume and all of these new phenomena that get built on top of Twitter. So it's that social dimension that's been very powerful.
That raises a question that I'd want to provoke you on about ubiquity. He compares Twitter to email and these services that have become so embedded in our lives. Twitter is still very much a single service kind of company. Email is ubiquitous. Is he kind of saying that Twitter is going to become, you know, the next email?
No, I don't think so. The question is, why is Twitter so a touchstone for conversation now at a place like Supernova? And it's because it's ubiquitous and because it's it is doing social things. But you do have to explain why Twitter has taken off. And I think part of the answer is that even though it's a single service, it's also become a platform for other developers to and users as well to add their own capabilities to use in a way that they want to.
And he was talking about collaboration and Twitter as an example of that. It sounds like there were a lot of entrepreneurs at Supernova who were trying to not to be the next Twitter, but to, you know, take advantage of some of the same sort of things that Twitter's taken advantage of.
And some of them, in fact, have products that run on top of Twitter that use Twitter information, use it as a platform. There were a bunch of entrepreneurs there, some familiar, some unfamiliar. And Twitter was used as an example of a larger trend that some of these entrepreneurs were in the space of, which is real-time collaboration. The real-time nature of it was the focus of an entire track one afternoon, and the subject of much discussion as well.
Why real-time?
It's a little hard to say. There's a bunch of new activity around that, new products and offerings. But I think in part it's because it's not just a new service, it's a new dimension to the web. And this is a forward-looking conference with forward-looking people. And so we're excited about the stuff that seems to be providing new ways to think about the web and new offerings that can be put forward. So we're used to the web as a set of pages. They're dynamic, but they're relatively slow given the pace of what's going on these days between Twitter and Google Wave and all the other tools. That's a field in which technology is really, really good. There's always room for improvement, but the technology for dealing with relatively static web pages, really, really good. There's so much that moves so quickly in real time through the web, or near real time anyway, that's a field that's just ripe for innovation and for commercialization and for thought. And so I think it just sort of interested people there that this new dimension is becoming so prevalent and so important to the culture.
And it means a lot for being able to have access to services and access to the collaborative nature that we're envisioning the web as being.
Yes, exactly, because it also does have, as you say, this collaborative, often this collaborative sense, and almost always a social sense. I mean, the real-time web is also the social web, and that social web is often collaborative, and that is appealing to many of the people at Supernova. It's a way we can work together and build great new things. So,
which is appealing to the Obama administration as well.
Yes, that's one of the things that's very interesting about the Obama administration's approach to the internet. And this year, because a good number of people in the Obama administration appointed to deal with the internet and its various aspects come out of either the Supernova crowd or the extended Supernova community, a whole bunch of them came back to the conference, which is sort of odd. Mm-hmm. Well, the people you saw last year who were just members of the community this year are coming from the White House, and that sort of generates a fair bit of excitement.
I bet. And for them, they're probably not dressed in jeans and sneakers as much as suits and ties. And
well, no. In fact, Andrew McLaughlin, who is also a Berkman colleague and was at Google and is now in the White House, he showed up in a sports coat and jeans and sneakers.
So they really have taken over the White House in a unique way.
Well, I asked Alec Ross that very question.
First of all, the State Department has more than 30,000 people. So among those 30,000 plus people, there are lots of different perceptions of the utility of the internet. At a leadership level, with Secretary Clinton and with those people who are really driving the vision of America's foreign policy, I think the view of the internet is that it is incredibly important. With 4.6 billion people now using mobile handsets, with mobile handsets becoming increasingly powerful and important, with networks having played such an important role in uprisings in places as varied as Iran, China, and Moldova, you really can't just view the internet as a tool of public diplomacy anymore. You have to view it as something that actually moves people and that moves organizations. Freedom of assembly, freedom of communication, all of these sorts of things really manifest themselves today on the internet more than anywhere else.
So one of the things that's interesting to me about the administration's adoption of the internet and sort of things I personally am looking for, and including in the State Department, is there's some more or less obvious things that you want a government to do. I mean, the most obvious is make with the internet, and one is to make information available over the internet and to automate some of the processes that we used to have to go stand on lines for. And those are hugely important things. It's where the government starts understanding the internet as being more than simply a publishing vehicle or a communication vehicle that I think we start to see some really exciting possibilities. And so I actually found the examples that Alec was giving to be quite encouraging.
And so one program that we're putting in place right now with the strong backing of the Mexican government and the strong backing of the State Department leadership is we're putting a program in place right now where people can anonymously report crime by text message and by email. The publicly identifiable information is stripped out. It's mapped up on a Google map. As soon as the crime reporting is mapped up, the command centers, the police, are going to have to respond within in a very short time. And then depending on what they find, they then have to respond back to the map with what they found. Yes, we found 3 tins of black tar heroin. No, we got there and there weren't any cartel member gangbangers. The idea is to bring transparency and accountability into crime fighting in Mexico and to reduce cartel-related violence. And so what that's evidence of is that people are thinking of technology in this case, not for the sake of technology, but as something that can help reduce violence. Another very different example can be seen in the East Congo, where there's an extraordinarily high level of sexual and gender-based violence. In the East Congo, what we're doing is we're using telecommunications as a way of enhancing the situational awareness of vulnerable populations, populations who are vulnerable to these roving bands of militias who come out of the Congolese hills. and predate upon vulnerable women and children. And so what we're doing is we're creating a messaging system using the internet, using cell phones, so that people can have increased situational awareness about the location and the movements of these bad guys. And so there, too, you can see this isn't about technology. This isn't about messaging. This is about hard, tough stuff.
There's been an initiative out of the White House to encourage people to be able to find answers from experts. And you actually spoke to one of the people who is trying to make that happen.
Yes, Anil Dash is a very interesting figure in the landscape. He was employee number one at Six Apart, and he's been very identified with a company. This is a company that makes blogging software, Movable Type, for example, that's used very, very widely. And I think it's safe to say that Anil Dash is held in high regard by the blogging community overall. He left that position, where he had a great deal of influence and respect, and he became very recently the head of a new project that's under the auspices of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, AAAS. But it's a project that was very explicitly spurred by the internet people in the White House, Beth Novick in particular. The project is called Expert Labs, and I find it to be quite interesting in a number of dimensions.
The immediate mission is we look at various federal agencies, the White House and other parts of the executive branch, and we think there's a real opportunity for moving past the model of today when you get outside expert opinions. You might get a half dozen or a dozen people in a room for an hour or two, maybe for one or two meetings, and that's the outside input process. If we can instead look at that as what we all do on Facebook and Twitter today of floating a question to a couple hundred of our closest friends or a couple thousand of our contacts, and then being able to take that and filter through the responses. Imagine that at a national scale, there's tremendous potential. It really gets to the core of the idea that there are experts out there among us, and they may not be accredited through the traditional means of earning a degree in a certain topic or being a member of a certain organization, but that we can expose that expertise collaboratively. And so first thing I think is we need to cast a wide net. I think we need to learn that lesson that we can get a very, very broad number of responses to a question. If the White House has millions of followers on Twitter and wants to get a question answered and gets hundreds of thousands of replies, that's an opportunity, not a problem. But then how do we narrow that down to a couple thousand good responses? Well, we can, use the technologies that are out there to say, well, which of these people are identified as registered lobbyists? Which of these people are members of an accredited educational institution? Which people have answered questions like this in the past before and expressed an interest over time? Which people are voted up by the other members of the community? And by making those filters visible, making it easier for people to create new ones and share them, we can author different views of that information. We can provide a really valuable way for people to discover information from each other, as well as providing answers to those policymakers.
That sounds like a really unique idea for a service, especially for the government to be offering.
Yes, I think it's unique in a couple of ways. First of all, the fact that the government, the White House, said, "Hey, this would be a good idea," and AAAS picked it up and ran with it, and then got MacArthur funding for it. That sort of private-public relationship is quite interesting. The willingness to, in a sense, crowdsource questions is fascinating. Now, it's not simply crowdsourcing. It's not that you throw the question open and anybody and everybody can answer it. Depending on the sort of question, you're also trying to make good use of the expertise of the scientists who are members of the AAAS. And so that mix of expert and public is also, I think, very, very interesting. And Anil says that as this platform gets more robust and capable, he wants to open it up not just to federal agencies that have questions, but this should be a general platform for getting reliable and maybe highly imaginative answers.
I do think by our very social nature, innately, humans are going to collaborate on getting a question answered if they can. I look at some of the communities that do a fantastic job of this online, and somebody will come up with a great answer initially, and somebody else will make it even better. That is something I think we can really tap into. If we set up the right reward and incentive structures, people are going to want to collaborate just by their own nature.
So, David, it sounds like you really, really enjoyed your time at Supernova.
I did, but I have a massive disclosure to make. A whole bunch of these people are my friends. I've known some of them for a long time, and I enjoy their company. But way more than that, Kevin Werbach, who I have known for a number of years now, he had Supernova pay my way out there and comped me for the conference because I moderated a couple of sessions, and that's what I had to get there. Second of all, Alec Ross, the State Department guy, I am on the verge of what looks like I'll be beginning doing some volunteer non-compensated consulting to the State Department that ultimately came through him. Anil Dash and his project, I was sort of in on the initial discussions. I have no continuing participation or, as in all these cases, there's no financial stuff going on. So nevertheless, it's a sort of tricky, sticky mess of stuff, and I thought I should at least mention it.
A tangled yet benign web that you weave.
Yeah, except for the being comped for the conference. Yes, I think it's benign.
Well, thank you so much for spending the time and letting us turn the mic over on you for the day and hear about what actually went on in this conference. It was really educational.
Well, thank you very much.
This has been the last show of the year 2009. We'll be excited to jump into 2010 and see whether any of these hot topics will still be relevant next year or what will take their place. What do you think the biggest topics of the year have been? Leave a comment on our blog, blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman. This episode of Radio Berkman was produced by me, Daniel Dennis Jones, with a lot of extra reporting work from the great David Weinberger at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts.